Of course, most of us probably know or first introduced to Hans either with the issues or the Lutheran satire and the like. I was really, really hoping he could have came up with a cool Lutheran satire just for us. Maybe he'll give us a shout out in one of those in the future. You never know.
Yeah, I talked to Ted about this last night, about an idea I had. I'll tell you guys the video idea. The problem is that this joke would only work for this audience, right. So that's why I haven't done it as a video. But the idea was, it's a guy who's been hired to come up with I wish I had some paint so I could do it. But a guy has been hired to come up with the logo for the Lutheran Church Canada, and he just doesn't do it. And so the meeting's about to start, and he's staring at a painting of the LCMS cross, and he just walks up to it and just goes,
Brilliant.
So that's the only. This is the only audience that would remotely.
Anyway, so Hans is going to be presenting on the titles "How the Art of Songwriting Can Help Our Preaching," the preach song. Let's welcome Brother Hans.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be out here with you guys. It's a beautiful piece of countryside you got here, so it's quite nice. I make fun of Canada, but I have fond affections for Canada. So my cousin Paul and I grew up spending our summers technically in Ontario. We always called it Minnesota because it was right on the border. And you would drive to the Minnesota side of the lake and then get in a boat and cross over to the Canadian side. So I have fond affections for the Canadian people, despite how you guys told me it's only in Ontario that they talk this way, where they say hoose instead of house and sorry instead of sorry, which they say quite a bit. So I like to make fun of you guys for that, but I am fond of the Canadians. This is a presentation I ended up. I first put together a couple of years ago. It was just an idea I had no. It was something I'd noticed in kind of my own preaching, and so it was something I put together and thought might be helpful for other guys. So kind of my fake qualifications for talking about this. So I spent a good number of years of my life aspiring to be the great American songwriter. I didn't get close. I wasn't ranked. So it wasn't like college basketball where I was hovering, you know, outside of the rankings. But sometime around like sophomore or so year, sophomore, junior high school, I started writing songs, usually about whichever girl I was in love with that particular minute. Did that all through college. I ended up in college. I ended up starting a band with some friends of mine. I went to Indiana University, which is one of the best music schools in the country. So I had some really great musicians in the band, guys I'm still very good friends with to this day. We weren't necessarily the greatest band in the world in that I was under the impression that I was going to be a rock star, but I'm sort of a low baritone. I'm trying to think of, there may be like one or two rock baritones in the history of the genre. There are very, very few of them.
Nickelback's lead singer.
Oh gosh, I have 5 minutes in Canada. I'm getting Nickelback love. Oh, it's terrible.
You guys have made it more of a star than we did.
Yeah. For sure.
We never quite found our right sound because the type of music I wanted, we wanted to be kind of like a hard rock, blues rock type band, and I just don't have the voice to kind of pull that off. And we had a guitarist who liked to sort of be a speed metal guy and a bass player who was more of a jazz guy and kind of stuff like that. So we never quite found a style that worked terribly well for us. We kind of graduated college and sort of went our own separate ways and pursued different avenues in life. I look back, I'm very glad that I didn't end up becoming a songwriter for this reason. That there are songwriters, there are basically two songwriters in the world. There's Paul McCartney and there's John Lennon. And by that I don't mean they're the only good ones. But what I mean is, there are songwriters who are inspired by joy, which is Paul McCartney, And then there are songwriters who were inspired by Sorrow, which is John Lennon. You can see this in the great double A-side single release from 1967 of Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane, or Penny Lane Strawberry Fields Forever, right? Which, we'll talk about Penny Lane in a little bit. Both of those songs are odes to each of those guys growing up in Liverpool. And Paul's is very fond and nostalgic and joyful about his existence growing up in Liverpool. And John's is sort of a drug-filled, hazy recollection of staring at this place, Strawberry Fields, which was an orphanage down the road from where he grew up. So they had kind of very different lives, even though they were very similar. They both had a parent die when they were their mothers both died when they were younger. Paul's died when he was about, I think, 9 or 10 years old, and John's died when he was about 16 or 17. But they're each guys who were motivated in different ways, it became very obvious, you know, when the Beatles broke up. The best example you can find of this is each of their respective Christmas songs, right? So John writes that Happy Christmas, War is Over If You Want It song, which is just insufferable, just self-important garbage. And then Paul writes that Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time, which is just cheesy showmanship garbage, right? So this is why the Beatles work so well, because they restrained each other. It was almost like a law and gospel kind of dynamic, where the law without the gospel is just sorrow and despair, and the gospel without the law is meaninglessness, and the joy doesn't mean anything because you're not being saved from anything. So despite the fact that I've always preferred Paul as the songwriter, what's that?
Most conservatives do.
Yeah, that's probably true.
There's a study.
Is it really?
There was. Yeah, that conservatives generally like Paul, and
yeah.
Liberals generally like John.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I would, so despite being a Paul guy, I was always much more of a John guy in terms of the type of how I was motivated. I was motivated by sorrow and hardship, and I struggled with depression quite a bit in college, so that's where a lot of my songs came from. So if ever there was a girl I was in love with, unrequited love, well, that's an endless resource of wonderful material. And so I felt like I was really kind of coming into my own as a songwriter and figuring out what I wanted to be and the kind of stuff I wanted to write shortly after college. So I wrote a good amount of stuff throughout that time. I'm not going to subject any of you to it because that just would feel awkward and weird. You'd be like, listen to the thing I made and then tell me it was good. It's sort of that, you know, that awkward artist thing where you're sort of dying for approval. So I just sidestepped the thing entirely. But there's still some stuff I wrote I'm still very proud of and think was really great. Most of it I'm not, but you know, there are 5-6 songs in there that I'm still pretty proud of today. But right kind of as I was coming into my own as a songwriter, I met my wife, and she ruined it all, because she made me happy. If you ever wanted to know why artists in general, musicians in particular, are so self-destructive, that's it. Because happiness is the end of your productivity. In particular, if you are a John songwriter, right? So I was very happy. I was more than willing to trade a wife and happiness and love and joy and children and all this stuff. I was very happy to trade songs for all of that. And that was a trade that worked very well in my favor. I would make it a million times over again. So I basically, by the time I met my wife, kind of gave up on that. I occasionally will write stuff here and there. My great frustration, and my friend Justin, who's in my band, one of my best friends, he was a keyboard player and the guy I kind of worked with the most throughout these years when I was kind of learning how to write songs. He said this to me once, and I wanted to get mad, then I realized it was true. He said, your gimmick songs are much better than your regular songs. And I went, yeah, you're kind of right about that. So you'll still occasionally see stuff like this, and a lot of Lutheran satire songs, I'll have little things I write in there. And I always get annoyed, like, eh, that's actually better than the stuff I tried to write when I was like being serious and wanting to change the world. That's irritating. But what are you going to do? It's kind of one of those things where God gives you a gift, and then you don't know what it's for, and then you find out what it's for. You're like, really? Is that? All right. Is that what I'm supposed to use it for? It was like I kind of found this out when I went to seminary. You know, I always wanted to be a rock star, and I wanted to have that high tenor screaming range, which the Lord did not give to me. And then I went to seminary, and I realized, oh, I have the perfect range for chanting the liturgy. And you're like, oh, all right, well, I guess if that's why I'm fine, if that's why you gave me that gift, Lord, okay. But what I eventually came to discover, a couple years into the ministry, was that a lot of the tricks I had learned in songwriting in terms of how do you structure a song, how do you link together pieces of music, how do you have a consistent theme in a song, how do you craft a story in just this relatively short span of time, I realized that I was actually implementing all of those things in how I was putting my sermons together. You guys know how pastors are. We all think we're good at preaching, and most of us are wrong. So it's kind of one of those things where you're always like, yeah, but I'm different. You know, where pastors are like, do you guys have prom in Canada?
We call it grad party. Yeah.
Grad party? Okay.
Yeah, prom is the same day as graduation.
Oh, okay.
So they wear the dresses under the graduation gown.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Well, so I don't. So part of the culture of prom, at least in the U.S., I don't know if this is also the case in Canada, is that it's a big deal as to who you're going to go to prom with. If it's a guy, you got to ask a girl to prom. It's not a big deal if you have a girlfriend because you know how that's going to work. But if you don't have a girlfriend, you're like, well, I got to go to prom with a girl. So you got to ask the girl. But then you figure like, well, she might as well be my girlfriend because I don't want to like go to prom with a girl and not kiss a girl. You know, that sort of seems weird to just be like, all right, well, thanks, have a nice night, you know, and go back home. So you have all these relationships that start on account of prom, right? And then they're all, and everyone, and they, this happens, and I used to tease my friends about this, be like, oh yeah, so-and-so and I are going out now. I'd go, oh yeah, you guys are going to break up right after prom. I'd go, no. This is different. This is special. And that's kind of how pastors are with preaching. We're like, yeah, you know, we all think we're good at it, but most of us are bad. And we all go, yeah, I know. But don't worry, I'm one of the good ones. I know. So we all think that about ourselves. I will not boast of my ability to rightly divide law and gospel. And there are a lot of ways in which I'm still trying to improve my own preaching. There are countless ways in which I'm trying to do that. But one thing I feel like I do have a good handle on is structure, is how to connect various pieces in a sermon and how to make everything fit and work together so your sermon is actually about something. And this is, if I were to say, I remember Matt Harrison said a number of years ago, someone asked him what the biggest crisis in the Lutheran Missouri Synod was, and his answer was preaching. And I completely agree with that, that there is a crisis of preaching, and I'd say a twofold crisis of preaching. The first is that there are a lot of guys who have no idea what it means to preach the gospel. And that's the bigger problem. That's not really what I'm going to be addressing here. I'm going to assume that you guys know the gospel, which is probably not necessarily a safe assumption to make in any collection of theologians. But that's not really so much the focus of my presentation. But I do think, just for the sake of saying it, I think that is a major problem in the LCMS. I assume things are no different in Lutheran Church Canada with that regard, where you have guys who just don't know the difference between saying nice sounding or comforting sounding things and actually speaking the word of comfort. This is, by the way, on a kind of side note, why it is that I think people struggle so much to understand why we are opposed to women's ordination. Because for most people, their understanding of what a pastor does, is basically, for them, it's basically the same thing as the speech that your aunt or grandmother or mother gives at Thanksgiving dinner. You guys have Canadian Thanksgiving?
Yeah, October.
Oh, okay. There you go. So, you know, it's that thing where, you know, mom has the whole family around the table, and she goes, oh, gosh, it sure is nice that we're all here, and I just think it's great that we're all getting along, and sometimes we don't always get along, and we could get along a little better, so maybe let's try to do that, but, oh, it's just so great to have you here, and we're just so wonderful. And for a lot of people, that's their understanding of preaching, is the pastor's getting up there going, oh gosh, guys, God sure is happy that we're all here, and sometimes we don't always do things that we should do and that God wants us to do, but, you know, maybe try a little harder, but, oh gosh, it sure, it would be nice if we could do that, that would be great, but oh, it's so great to have you all here. That's that type of thing. And we're guys, we just think that's preaching the gospel, that just making people feel happy and comfortable, and it's completely disconnected from authority and from the devil and condemnation and hell. And I think that's oftentimes why people have a hard time understanding why women can't be pastors, because you're going, well, because the pastor's the guy who walks into the room with the devil, you know, and handles the devil with the word of God. I mean, if the exorcist were going on upstairs in your house, and you've got a kid's head spinning around and spewing out green vomit and cursing at you in backwards Latin or whatever it is that happens in the movie. If that were happening, you know, visibly every day in the church, you would not have people going, hey, can we ladies be the ones to go in there and deal with that, right? If you had ISIS marching through North America and lopping off people's heads and gathering all the Christians together and, you know, flaying the pastors alive first, you wouldn't have people going, you know, I really think it's not fair that women can't be pastors as well. Wanting women's ordination is the luxury of a church that's not enduring suffering and persecution. I think that has, that same absence of suffering and persecution has really harmed our preaching, because we don't, there's no sense that we're up against anything. So in that sense, that's a separate battle. If you want to have someone next year come talk about that, that's great. But what I see as another huge problem in preaching is, it's not that guys aren't preaching the gospel. It's just that it's impossible to grab onto it because you don't know what the heck they're talking about in their preaching. I'm sure you guys have had this experience. I always think pastors should get more vacation time and get more Sundays off. And then I go to church on vacation at some place, and I go, oh my gosh, never mind, if that's what I'm going to have to listen to. So it's great if you can go to churches where you have great preaching, and that does happen a lot. But I'm sure you guys have had that where it's a vacation or whatever it is, or you're at a pastor's conference or something, and a guy gets up, and about 2 minutes in, you're going, what are you talking about? There's no sense of anything. It's just random statements all over the place. I meant to have a video of this. I forgot to grab that. The way I would describe it is, if you remember back in the 90s, before the dawn of iTunes, if you wanted to just get a collection of song, you know, disco songs from the 70s or kind of new wave pop songs from the 90s or from the 80s, they'd sell on TV and they'd have those commercials for them. And they'd run through the list of songs, right? And on those commercials, as they're running through, oh, these are all the songs in this 4-CD collection, they'd play, you know, 10-second snippets of songs, so you're getting 10 seconds of And I Ran, you know, by the Flock of Seagulls, and then I'll Melt With You by, who sang that? Which band sang that? I'll Stop the World and Melt With You. Yeah, it's going to drive me nuts.
Toad the West Rocket.
That's not Toad the West Rocket.
What page are we on for this?
We'll get there. We'll get
there. Yes. Sorry. Yeah. I was just trying to take notes.
No.
We're not. Introduction.
Yeah,
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Is that the Canadian sorry? All right. So.
I really thought. No,
yeah, no, I don't, my notes, I just, the only notes I provided are just for the parts where I'm kind of going through song lyrics.
Okay.
So, I'm not a big fan of handouts, mainly because people judge you by how far you're getting through it. You've all had that experience in Bible class, like, we only got through one third of the page today. You're like, well, I had a lot of things to talk about. Those were three very loaded, full verses. So nonetheless, I think that what ends up happening is guys mean to preach the gospel, but it just gets buried underneath the rubble of no structure. that I used to, there's a church I went to a number of times when I was in seminary, where I would, my way I would describe the pastor's preaching was just 15 minutes of peeper statements, right? So it was just this doctrinal statement here, that doctrinal statement here, that, you know, so Jesus is the Son of God, we are all sinners, it was important for Jesus to be born of a virgin, that kind of all this stuff. Yeah, did you have a...
Well, it's just, you're reminding me of Aho's thing about the lively skeleton or whatever, right? The fear of Jell-O being a good motivator for structuring your preaching.
I've never.
Yeah, Gerhard Aho wrote this little monograph called "The Lively Skeleton" about the importance of structure in preaching.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah,
I'd like to actually once when I'm not lecturing, just talk with you guys about kind of what, if for those of you who went to the Canadian seminaries, kind of what your homiletics classic for life. This is my suggestion. No one asked for my suggestion at the Fort Wayne Seminary where I went, but my suggestion would be get rid of almost all of the practical courses and teach like 5 more classes on preaching. You know, do an entire class on sermon structure and stuff like this. Because the practical courses, no two situations are ever the same. And so you come out of the seminary and you never get the scenarios that the professor was telling you about, and then you have a thing that's totally different show up, and you're like, well, they didn't prepare me for that. All right, but kind of going back to that notion of the old 90s compilation CDs, right? That's what these sermons are like, is it's just 10, you're not getting a sermon, you're getting 10-second snippets of 400 sermons or whatever it is across the course of a sermon. And Walther has a quote kind of on this notion where the gospel, and certainly the idea is that it's not that the gospel doesn't predominate because it's not being preached or because there aren't more words about the gospel than words about the law. It's that the gospel isn't predominating because people just can't hold on to it. They don't have anything that they can kind of sink their teeth into. So this is from Thesis 7 from Walther's Law and Gospel. He says, the biggest problem with modern preaching, my dear friends, is this. These sermons lack point and purpose. It's nice to know that nothing ever changes. It's sort of when one thing you go, oh, that makes me feel good, and then you go, oh, wait, well, maybe I shouldn't waste my time talking about this because it's not going to make a difference then. And this fault is particularly noticeable in the sermons of our contemporary preachers who are believers. While unbelieving and fanatical preachers have a definite goal, too bad that it is not the right one, believing preachers, as a rule, imagine that they have fully discharged their office as long as they have preached the Word of God. This is about as correct a view as when a hunter imagines he has discharged his office simply by sallying forth with his loaded gun and blasting aimlessly into the forest, or as when an artilleryman thinks he has done his duty by taking up his position in the line of battle and merely firing his cannon into the blue. Just as the latter are poor hunters and soldiers, the former are poor and useless preachers, because they have no plan in mind and do not take aim when preaching. While their sermons may contain beautiful thoughts, they do not have any impact. They may occasionally make the thunder of the law roll in their sermons, yet there is no lightning that strikes. Again, they may water the garden assigned to them with the fruitful waters of the gospel, but they pour water on the flower beds and the paths of the garden indiscriminately, and their effort is lost. So you kind of get these, you get sermons like this, where you can see Walther was certainly dealing with this in his day. This is, I suppose, one of the challenges of being a theologian, is that you want to talk about theology, whereas non-theologians want to tell stories and, you know, have you ever heard those sermons? You get to a sermon, guy starts and starts telling you the story, and you go, "I hope this story is connected to the gospel." And then he goes, "Ah, that reminds me of another time." And you go, "Oh no, this is not going to be good." So there's no kind of connection to the text, no connection to the idea. So at least with theologians, they want to talk about theological ideas, but there's oftentimes just no connection between them. So you kind of get this, "Oh, God is love," and distrust, disobeying our earthly authorities is sinful, and Jesus is true God and true man, and the church is the body of Christ, and we're all sinners, and there's no suffering in the life to come, and you know we should all share the love of Jesus with our neighbors. And it's all the statements are true, but there's no kind of connection to them. So it's a little bit like, and the other problem too with this is that the statements are true, but people don't know how to mine any meaning out of it. So if you're just throwing theological statements at people from the pulpit, they will know that those are the words that we Lutherans say, but they won't actually know what they mean. You know, I mean, you can tell your people, you can say we're justified by grace alone through faith alone, and you can get Lutherans to repeat that. But getting them to actually understand what it means is a taller order, and requires you to just kind of focus on that one thing, which you can't do if you're sort of going all over the place. I don't know if you guys have ever gone to a concert that where you thought you sort of, you know, it's like a summer thing, and like $5 or someone gives you a free ticket, and you can go see a bunch of 80s bands or whatever it is. So you go and you go, I know those band songs. And then you realize you only know like the choruses to the songs. And so they get up there and you go, oh, good, I'm going to sing along to this one. You sing along for 5 seconds, then you go, I don't know the rest of this song. And that's a little bit what I think preaching becomes like, in the sense where we go, yeah, I kind of know a little bit of that here and a little bit of that there. But the full scope of the thing is just not present. What does it mean that God is love? What does righteousness mean? What does the bride of Christ mean? By the goal of a sermon ought to be focusing on certainly one idea, one theme that's in a text, one consistent idea that you're unpacking. So I think that this is certainly something that that hearers need to have. And I think in particular, what we're kind of sort of dealing with contextually in our world today is we have a very different world now in terms of how people consume information. I was in Germany a couple summers ago, and there was, we were in this old Lutheran church, and there was, right next to the pulpit, there were these three sand dial things, whatever you call them, you know, things that measure time. What's that?
Hourglass.
They weren't a full hour, but we have so mini versions of an hourglass, half hour glasses, whatever you want to call them. So people were asking about it, and the guy during the church, and people said, oh, was that to make sure that the pastor didn't preach too long? And the response was, no, that was to make sure that the pastor preached long enough. Which, you know, it makes sense, especially in that context when you'd have people who were farmers and stuff like that who were walking maybe 3-4 hours to church.
Right.
If someone walks 4 hours to church, don't preach a 15-minute sermon. There was a hunger then for people to be devouring the gospel, you can see this a lot when you read Luther's sermons. That he could just talk and talk and talk, you know, it's hard to imagine how long he was preaching, and people were just, this was the context in which he was able to do that. And nowadays, you know, when we're living in a world where television has kind of fried everyone's attention spans, and it's not just that it's fried our attention spans, but when you look at the way people consume information, right, so if you're reading the news, people are reading about one article at a time. Is there a typewriter back there? What is going on?
Yeah. Roofing.
Oh, okay. I thought someone was just sitting there taping notes. I was waiting for the ding, you know. Okay. Now that I know what it is, I can ignore it.
He's got old school longer than clicky clock.
Yeah. When people are reading the news, they are reading an article about one thing at a time. When they're watching TV shows, or when they're watching, when they're watching news on the TV, when they're consuming information, you generally are getting one segment at a time. So you're probably, if you're watching Fox News or CNN or whatever it is, and you're watching kind of commentary TV, you know, they've got, all right, we're going to spend 15 minutes talking about this, talking about this on this segment. We're going to spend 10 minutes talking about this. So you're essentially getting, they're not sermons, but, 10-minute or 15-minute snippets of something, and then we move on to something else, and we dissect that. So this is books as well. So if people are reading books to learn about the world and become informed about the world, you know, even if books are covering a number of different topics, they're generally focusing, you know, one chapter per section. So people are just used to kind of focusing on one idea at a time. And then, of course, if you're looking at entertainment, you have a very similar thing. So, you know, like with TV, you'll have an episode that may cover, you know, like in the old sitcom format, there's usually an A story and a B story. And there's maybe sometimes a connection between the two. I think, by the way, one of the greatest trivia, if you've ever played Trivia Night, one of the greatest Trivia Night categories would be match the Seinfeld A story with the B story. You know, so like the episode where, you know, George is trying to get fired from the Yankees, what's the other thing, you know, that's happening in that episode? I think that would be a great Trivia Night question. But for the most part, you have shows that tend to be this, you know, this is the one thing that's happening, at least at this time. And so even if it's not the entire episode, it's a good, you know, here's a 10-minute or an 8-minute segment about this part of the story, and then we move on to this part of the story, you know, and then you kind of wrap it up at the end. Movies, obviously, you get kind of the same thing. People go to movies where there's sort of an interesting story to them that's focusing on that one specific story. Kind of same thing with books and novels, and then obviously, kind of what I'm talking about here in music, that's very much what people are used to is, you know, for example, a song like Band on the Run, right, which is basically like five mini songs sort of put together and then kind of, you know, vaguely tied together with some sort of vague story. It's kind of a fun song, but what makes it fun is that it deviates from what people are normally used to, you know, which is that the song focuses on one idea, one emotion, and it may weave in, you know, a number of kind of musical motifs or ways of sort of looking at the problem or the thing or the issue, whatever it is. But you're not just getting, I'm talking about this girl I love over here right now for 30 seconds, and then I'm going to talk about social injustice over here, you know, we're going to be a protest song for a little bit, and then we're going to be a stadium rock anthem for a little bit. So the way that people are, I think, just used to consuming information is there's a fairly natural structure in all of the things that, in all the ways that people consume both information as well as entertainment. So I think that sort of raises the question. We have this tendency, people have this tendency to say, and that begs the question when they mean raises the question. And I feel like we all die a little bit inside when people misuse that term. So it raises the question, well, what is preaching? And I think, of course, we want to say, and it's true, that preaching is, in fact, teaching. So we want to say preaching is not entertainment. But I think the reality of the situation is that, all right, well, in what other avenues do people listen to someone standing up and talking to them for 15 minutes at a time? You know, someone who's basically mic'd up is the center of attention. And what other avenues do people have for that? And I suppose you can say kind of like like Fox News type of thing, you know, where you got the talking head, you know, guy talking to the camera for about 15 minutes. But Fox News is far more entertainment than it is information. And likewise, I mean, you could say stand-up comedy is actually probably the closest thing to preaching, just in terms of what's actually going on. That's, you know, in the secular world. Where you've got a comedian's going to work on, I'm going to talk about this topic, you know, like if you buy stand-up albums, which is a thing that people used to do. I don't know if they still put out albums anymore, but, you know, they'd have, you know, 9 tracks or so, that, you know, the tracks would be about, you know, anywhere from like 5 to 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes long, where a guy's going off on a rant about this and a rant about that and a rant about that. So, and then he would kind of weave things together, and that's, of course, always how the show would end, is that you throw back to some joke, you know, that you put out earlier. But that, you know, I think in a lot of ways that's actually probably closer in format to preaching than virtually anything else, because people don't go to lectures anymore. I mean, once you're done with school, I mean, obviously the closest thing is a lecture. But once you're done with school, no one ever goes to those things anymore. There may have been a time when people would, you know, when that was sort of like the thing that the upper crust would do, is they'd go and they'd hear a lecture about some sort of topic. But folks don't do that anymore.
The salon?
The salon?
Yeah, when you hair salon, but if you have a meeting of salon where you get together and listen to someone talk.
Oh, is that what salon actually means?
Yeah.
I did not know. Okay. Yeah. So, and is there a connection there with saloon? Are those the same? Is that company the same with you? Mm. So the barbershop then would be that type of thing. So I like to go get my hair cut at this place because it's an old guy's place, and I thought, oh, this would be fun. I'll take my sons here to get their hair cut. And then the second time I went, there's this old World War, or I think it's like a Korea veteran, who just swears so many times all over, and is constantly talking about how he wants to engage in inappropriate acts with every single woman who walks by. And the guy's like 80, so they're not gonna, you know, they're not gonna tell him to shut up. And I thought, well, I probably won't bring my sons to this place. They'll have to just go to Supercuts like the good suburbanite kids that they are. So I think that despite our best intentions and despite everyone and despite our people's best intentions, their brains have just been trained to expect a kind of a certain way for the to expect a certain thing. So this is, I think, one of my, I don't know how you guys feel about this. One of these days, I've sort of threatened this before. One of these days, I'm going to make good on this, at least one week. Is that I tell people, you have to come to Bible class, because the reality is I need to preach for an hour, but I can't preach for an hour. People's brains can't, we can't do it. It's not a battle I'm going to be able to win. I need you guys to be able to come to Bible class so that you can learn stuff. Because I don't have, you know, if I'm preaching on a sermon and it's sort of an end of times text, right, and I want to talk about the gospel and the forgiveness of sins and all this stuff, I just don't have time to go through all of why Left Behind and all of that rapture stuff is wrong. I'm not going to take a 35-minute diversion in a sermon to do that. Luther could, but they in that Bible class, it was just you listen to the guy for as long as he was going to talk. So that's not a luxury that we have, and so I think just despite people's best intentions, this is the way their brains are essentially trained to think. If I were to, just to kind of put things simply, I have until what time?
30.
Okay. 10:30. If I were to put things very simply, I guess this is just the way I would put it, is that this, in order for a sermon to work, in order for it to be a good sermon, at least in terms of structure, it just has to be about something. That's, I think, the simplest way that you can put it, is that if you were to say to someone who would listen to that sermon, what was it about? And if they've genuinely listened and are of, that's always sort of a terrifying question to ask. Do you guys have your confirmation students take sermon notes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, and you read them and you're going, oh gosh, it's so much worse than I thought it would be. And then you realize, like, oh, then it's probably not any better for their parents either. You have that thing where, this is what I ask in sermon notes. I ask three questions. I say, what law did the pastor preach? As I talk with them a lot about law and gospel. What gospel did the pastor preach? And then the last thing is just simply, what was the sermon about? And that's not so much for them as much as it is for me. I want to be able to make sure that, you know, people who are relatively listening can tell you in a couple sentences, this is what the sermon was about. And I think that in just, kind of going back to when I say there's sort of a lack of structure, that I think is one of the chief problems. Is that you can't summarize what a sermon was about. Like, when was the last time you heard a really bad sermon? At least in terms of not necessarily one where just rank heresy was preached, but just a sermon where you go, oh my gosh, that was a bad sermon. For me, at least in most of those cases, that's because I would say, I have no idea what on earth that guy was talking about. What was the point of everything that he said? There's nothing to kind of to cling to. So I think that's a, so the, yeah, the question is just simply, that, or the people simply need to have something that they can sink their teeth into. And without a solid structure, you don't actually give them something that they can devour, something that they can meditate on and think about. People's attention spans are just sort of shot. And I think, too, one of the main problems with this is when there's not a good structure to a sermon, because people's attention spans are shot, they have a tendency, they just, their minds wander. And this, I'm sure this happens to all of us too, where this would happen to me in seminary, you know, all the time, where, you know, you're sitting there and you're trying to listen and your brain goes, hey, think about this other thing for 30 seconds. And you do, and then you go, no, I'm going to listen to the Word of God. And then you kind of lean back in and you go, I have no idea what happened or where this thing went, and I can't find my way back into what this guy's talking about. It's a little bit like if you come into a Seinfeld episode 5 minutes in, and you're going, I don't know why anything is funny, because you missed the thing that's, you know, that set up the entire episode. So you're just going, I know that funny things are apparently happening, but I've lost the frame of reference, and I can't quite get back in. So I think when it comes to the structure of songwriting, when it comes to the idea of picking up and of using a theme in the way that songs have a tendency to do, that can really help our preaching in a sense that for people whose attention spans are just shot, it gives them an ability to jump back into the thing. It gives them a point where they can go, okay, now I know where we are, and I may have missed this bit here, but I can kind of get back to where we were before. Which again, I think is a huge problem with these sermons that are just kind of, hey, we've got the statement over here and that statement over here, and then you're not really sure where all this thing is going. So I think that's allowing people to have something they can sink their teeth into, allowing them to have something, allowing them a means to get back into a sermon when they've forgotten where they are. None of this, of course, means that they're necessarily going to be able to tell you, you know, in a year or 6 months or even next week what the sermon was about. And that's obviously the thing that we deal with, you know, in preaching, is you just go, well, I'll just throw this out there, I'm going to speak faithfully, and I'm going to trust that even if people can't remember the specific details, that, you know, over time this is going to build up a solid foundation. So that's of course always the great anxiety of a pastor, is that you spend like 30 years trying to make your people faithful Lutherans, and then you go, I hope after I die they don't call a moron who ruins everything that I did in 5 minutes. I think that's at least the anxiety that I feel when I look at my congregation. I don't know about you guys, but that's certainly a fear, especially because they tell you, don't be overly involved in the call process. Like if you take a call and they say, well, let the congregation figure it out, which I'm distrustful of, because congregations don't usually figure things out in a vacuum. They need someone to lead them. And so when you're not leading them, it's the district president who's leading them. So I'm a little skeptical about that thing. I don't know, although I do think that, do you ever have that feeling where you think, like, sometimes I want to leave the ministry just so I can be the most amazing layman ever? So good at this. And one of the things was like, oh man, I would want to be on a call committee so bad. Because I feel like I can tell you within a good 15 seconds as to whether or not a guy is going to be a decent preacher or not. You know, sometimes you might be a little bit misled. But have you ever been to a service and the pastor starts preaching, and like 3 words in, you go, oh, it's not going to be good. This is not going to go well. So you guys are maybe nicer than I am, but which is entirely possible. So what does songwriting offer? Songwriting is really ultimately all about story. So it's what is the artist singing about? Who are the characters? What's kind of the emotional core of the thing? What's happening to them? There's a musical connection between things. So you don't find a lot of songs that are typically like hymns where there's kind of, you know, one musical bit and then it's just that repeated. You'll find a handful of pop songs like this, where it's the melody for the chorus is the same as for the verses and stuff. But there aren't a whole lot like that. So there tend to be a number of parts, which is usually what you're looking for in a sermon, because you're trying to weave your way through a text, trying to weave your way through the application of law and gospel. So what songwriting does is, you know, you don't have a change in tempo or key or style with every verse. There's generally something that's connecting all of it, and when there is a dramatic shift in the music, there's generally a dramatic shift in the story, which is a very helpful thing to employ in preaching. Obviously, lyrically, there's a connection between the various pieces of a song as well, and the changes in music will accompany that. So as the lyric progresses and as the story unfolds, there's a great model to that that we can follow in preaching that enables you to basically focus on one idea without saying everything that you need to say about it. I think this is probably one of the reasons why you get a lot of these 15 minutes of Piper statement sermons, where you just have things that are disconnected, is because for a lot of us, and a lot of times, it's just hard to know how to mine an idea, how to talk for 10, 15, 20 minutes, however long you preach, about just about basically one or two words, maybe or half a phrase or whatever it is. And so we have a tendency to move on where we kind of go, okay, I said all of the things that I said about that. Like when someone asks you to have an opinion about something you don't really care about, and then they want to talk about it more, and you're like, I talk for a good, solid three sentences about that thing, and then I ran out of things to say about it. So basically, I think if a good song can progress a story and tell a story in a span of 3 or 4 minutes by virtue of good structure, we should certainly be able to implement kind of that same sort of model and that same idea for a 15 or so minute sermon. I don't know how long you guys preach. I tend to vacillate a bit. If I have a manuscript, if I've written out a manuscript, it's usually around 15 minutes. If I just write an outline, which I don't do very often, well, who knows? That could be a long sermon. In the next session, I'll spend a bit more time. We'll start kind of looking at various examples of this, and kind of analyzing some different types of song structure and stuff like that, and then move on eventually to how to apply this in preaching. You guys have any questions so far?
Just one comment. I've heard some members say, "Well, Pastor, we're here Sunday morning for an hour because we have a life outside of church."
Yeah.
In Luther's day, what else were they going to do?
Right. Yeah, no, I do think that is a huge challenge culturally. In some ways, I think that pagan Europe has it easier than us in this regard. The whole town shuts. They still have that remnant of cultural Christianity where the whole town shuts down on Sunday. The whole town is closed for Christmas and things of this nature. And yeah, those of you who have been pastors for a while now can maybe pinpoint with a bit more accuracy than I can when this happened. I presume this is the issue of, like, for example, youth sports is a big issue up here as well. But it seems, I don't remember as a kid anyone having games on Sunday morning. You'd have, if you were doing club stuff and things like that, you'd have games on Saturdays. Schools never had things on Sunday mornings. And it was almost like just a couple of years ago, 5, 10 years ago or so, it was like the culture just sort of looked at us and went, we think you'll show up on Sunday morning. And we went, no, we won't. We are Christians. We are a Christian nation. We will not do that. We take church seriously. And the sports culture went, yeah, we're going to call your bluff on that. We think you'll show up. So then they schedule everything on Sunday morning, and you got what you got. Yeah, and it's sort of like people have the sense of, I think we were talking about this last night, that people get surprised when Christianity's hard. The most frustrating, I think that's probably the most frustrating thing to deal with, because I just want to say, like, what did you expect was going to happen? Did you think that this was going to be easy? When you keep reading about all these guys suffering persecution and all this stuff, did you really think never at any point in their life were you ever going to have to give anything up? And I think the problem is that when you are... if you don't have to give anything up until you're 25, 30 something years old, you're just not going to start then. It's like if you don't, most people who are real athletic and in really good shape, that's been an earlier on thing. You generally don't start. Some guys will start running marathons when they're 40s, in their 40s, but it tends to be a little bit rare, and they tend to be people who have still been, somewhat active. But, we all experience this where it's just, your kid's got to be in church, and they go, well, I know, but what am I going to do about it? What are you going to do about about your kid being involved in a voluntary organization that you are allowed to leave at any point with no like threat of, you know, being thrown in jail or anything. How about you just don't go? This is not hard to figure out. And that's a very difficult thing when it comes to preaching, is because you don't have an hour. You know, people think that you're lucky to be getting what you're getting from them. And so I think that on one hand we got to fight that battle, but on the other hand we also got to realize until we make a lot of ground in that aspect of things and on that front, we got to find a way to have a little bit more bang for our buck and a little bit more to be conveying a little bit more than we have been, you know, in the 20 or so minutes of preaching that you're able to instill in. So, any other? All right, I think I finished.
We're back here at 11 o'clock.